On this episode of the Fear Me Out podcast, I have the pleasure of welcoming a longtime friend onto the show. His name is Dr. Robert Permit. I met Rob when I actually worked in a psychiatric ward while I was in school back in the late 70s and early 80s. We've been acquainted ever since. Rob is a psychiatrist, and I met in the context of him working with his patients that were hospitalized at the time. At that same time, our wives became best friends and have been very close ever since. Rob agreed to come on the podcast to talk about anti-Semitism, which I think is a really important topic right now, and how he, as a Jewish person, is coping with what's happening in the world. So it's a very serious, sad episode in a certain way, but I think it's really important that we talk about anti-Semitism. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of inviting a longtime friend, Dr. Robert Permit. I met Rob back in, the late 70s, probably. I was in school working at a psychiatric unit, and Rob was a psychiatrist at the time that occasionally had patients come into the unit. So I got to know him through that venue. And also our wives work together as nurses and become very good friends. And they've been friends forever and still enjoy each other's company. I wanted Rob to come in specifically because he is an incredibly intelligent, very well-read, well-spoken person. And this podcast is all about anti-Semitism and Rob's experience with that, along with what he's learned about what's happening in the Middle East right now. So, Rob, I want to thank you for coming in, and tell us a little bit about yourself, more detail, if you don't mind.
My pleasure, Dana. Thanks very much. I was pleasantly surprised when you called and asked if I'd participate, but certainly glad to do so, as you say, based on the topic, as well as not only that, supporting the good work that you do with your podcast. My background's kind of interesting in this regard. My parents both served in Pearl Harbor, and when they came back to Cincinnati, Ohio, which is where I grew up, they were in the midst of, you know, what was going on there with all the construction after the war for people to live in relatively small, modest houses, which is all people could afford. And my parents picked a house in an area that they could afford. It was a suburb of Cincinnati called Hartwell. And we were about three or four blocks from the primary school. And this was one of the schools, kindergarten through sixth grade. And it soon became clear that I was the only Jewish student in the school. And when I say it soon became clear, because it was surprising to me, obviously, not knowing anything any different, to walk into school and to be taunted, even as a kindergartner, where we were going half days of school. And, you know, I didn't understand it. It made no sense to me why somebody would, you know, sit there and say, hey, Jew boy, or hey, kike, or whatever nasty kinds of words people like to use.
How did they know you were Jewish at such a young age?
It's a good question because, you know, my name does not sound, if you will, stereotypic.
No, Permit. Certainly not like mine, which is like, you know, super Jew.
Right. And I have no idea, unless, again, somehow in the community, the name or what we were somehow permeated, because why would little kids say those words anyway, right, if they weren't told them at home and discussed that at home?
Right. And this started as a five-year-old.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, you're just, you know, now at this age or any other age as an adult, you sort of begin to understand it, but you're just this little kid. And, you know, so you go home to your parents and say, well, A, I mean, I know what Jew is, but I really didn't have any connotation of what Jew boy meant, and certainly not kike and other kinds of pejorative terms that were used. And, you know, why are they saying that to me? And what does that mean? And am I supposed to do anything or not do anything, or what do I do? And so, you know, even at that age, you don't have sort of full abstract reasoning power in your mind, you know, about how you might handle these kinds of things. So my folks just took the sort of tack that prejudice comes out of ignorance, and that these were ignorant people who were saying those kinds of things, and that I should not mind them, in a sense that that view them as, what's the source? The source isn't very wise. The source is not very intelligent. The source is not very well-rounded and humanistic. And, you know, do my best just to sort of, you know, walk the line and ignore it. Just go to school and do what I was supposed to do. And, you know, that worked pretty well for a few years. And then probably around third grade, I'm guessing back, it's been a long time, but I remember that because then it began with some of the sort of, we were now beyond what you might call verbal bullying. Now we're into a little bit of more physical bullying, you know, with people sort of coming up and pushing you and saying those things to you, and you don't belong here, and why are you here, and you know, you don't believe like the rest of us believe. And again, this was obviously a virtually 100% white Anglo-Saxon, you know, Protestant kind of neighborhood. And of course, there's no answer to that per se, but I did start to, you know, I would say unfortunately, but, you know, you get into some fights, physical fights. And, you know, when you do that, if it's one person that you're trying to fight, you know, you might have a chance, but if it's several who are picking on you. So the principal was a really nice man who did his best to intervene at times. And we had some discussions with me and my parents in his office about, well, maybe you should just get to, in other words, you know, there was like playtime before school. You could get out in the schoolyard and play kickball, or you could, you know, do other kinds of stuff. And, you know, maybe you ought not show up until right before school starts. And if any of this happens in the hallways, you know, you should try and talk to a teacher. But that didn't always work. And the irony of all this physical part was that my folks decided that summer to send me for my first summer at an away camp. And this was a Jewish-sponsored camp in a place called Loveland, Ohio, which seemed like a very, very far away at that time for a young kid, but yeah, Wasn't that far away. And they had, obviously, the typical things that camps have, you know, campfires and, you know, various kinds of activities. But one of the things that they had that summer were boxing lessons. And There was a fellow who actually, if people remember the Olympics, and they remember, you know, years ago the Olympics, when a kid like Aaron Pryor, for example, was a black kid, came out of Cincinnati and ended up being like a lightweight champion, but fought in the Olympics. And one of the coaches was a fellow by the name of Raleigh Schwartz. Obviously, it was a Jewish man.
Yeah.
And he was very sort of stereotypic in the sense of, you know, had white hair that he combed back straight and really put people through their paces. And so I had, along with other kids attending camp, true boxing lessons. So you learn what's a jab, and what's a right cross, and what's a left hook, and how do you do combination boxes, and how do you parry people trying to box against you. And and this was just serendipitous in terms of the fact that this was available that particular summer. So
your parents didn't know that you were being sent to boxing camp?
Well, it wasn't really a boxing camp. That No, they didn't.
That was
it just was one of those things. I mean, we obviously swam and played tennis and baseball and ran around and had campfires and did all kinds of stuff that most kids do at camps. as well as some, you know, some religious training as well. So now I'm in fourth grade and I'm going back to school, and I'm just not looking for a fight, not looking for a problem, but in the back of my head, I had talked to these coaches, including uh-huh. this Raleigh Schwartz, and he said, you know, if somebody really, you know, comes and attacks you, use what we've taught you, and as much as I hate to say it because it sounds very crass, you know, do your best to just bloody them up.
Right.
I mean, just do your best to make them pay for what they're doing, and that will likely send a message, and you probably won't be bothered again.
Right.
And turned out to be true. Literally the first day of school, I was accosted and got into a fight and did use those skills that I had learned, and the result ended up being that way. So
so you beat the crap out of the kid?
I did. I shouldn't laugh.
Why? It's an habit.
But yes, I did. I mean, and you know, as with a lot of people who are listening to this probably saw fights in their various schools, and usually what ends up happening, if other people don't jump in, then what ends up happening, a big circle forms around,
yes, yeah.
and everybody's watching, and
right.
some people are cheering and some people are being quiet.
Right.
But they were watching, and nobody else jumped in. And when they saw that I was, I think, you know, at that point, pretty deft, it wasn't like I was ever going to be a Golden Gloves boxer or something like that, but enough to defend myself uh-huh. and to make somebody pay for it. So that changed along the way. Now, to segue away from the actual school time, also, you know, you're living in a neighborhood, and we had this little area called Valleydale and Hartwell where we lived. There were about six streets that would be the equivalent of, you know, each street had maybe the equivalent of two blocks of houses on it. And there were about six of these streets as they sort of went up a hill. And so obviously on your street, there are kids who would normally play. And so you could be out riding bikes, or there'd be kids who'd be playing toss with baseball or football, or there'd be basketball. And it was the same kind of thing where, you know, I'd walk down the street and I'd see a game of basketball going on in somebody's backyard or driveway, and I'd wander back, and, you know, I would never get invited to play in the game. Now, there wasn't taunting going on, but I was just being ostracized.
How did they know that you were Jewish,
and
though?
Ignored.
How did they know? It's so puzzling.
It is puzzling. Mm. But obviously, you know, one knew. So similarly, again, I mean, this is, as I say, it's a, if you will, a more subtle form of being excluded and ostracized than somebody coming up and taunting you or trying to get in a fight with you.
Right.
But again, I'd go home because I'm not a great athlete, but I was pretty athletic and,
uh-huh.
and pretty capable,
right.
As proved later in my life when I got into, you know, high school and college. But, you know, I again go home and say, you know, I showed up down there, and, you know, they wouldn't let me play. They didn't invite me in, and I even asked, and they said, you know, we don't have room and whatever else. So you talk to your folks about this kind of stuff, and, you know, they basically, you know, again said, well, you know, again, these are ignorant people, and there's nothing wrong with you, because they wanted to make sure that I wasn't internalizing
sure.
this sense that there was something wrong with me somehow.
But were you, despite what they said, or do you think you were able to?
I'm sorry?
Were you able to kind of put it aside, or did it affect you more than
yeah,
they realized?
You know, very hard to say for sure. I think there are probably times where that I did, you know, maybe have a little self-doubt. Well, what's wrong with me and why that? But then when you brought it back to the context of, you know, the religious bias and the ostracization being due to that, not that there was something wrong per se with me, other than from these people's perspective, I was the wrong faith. So I don't think I internalized it a lot. I certainly didn't, you know, sort of overdo it but I just did sort of accept it, which was, we can argue and think about that. I mean, should I have tried to force myself onto the court? Should I have, you know, taken one person, say, you know, I'm coming in for you. I don't care whether you want to go out or not. You know, there's all sorts of ways to have been maybe more aggressive at that point. And so perhaps I was, you know, retrospectively, you know, a little hesitant to do that, and therefore maybe not as sure of myself, you know, because of all this as I might have been. But, you know, I don't know that I would call myself a mellow person, but you know, I'm relatively even keeled, and so I think that you know, it would have probably taken some gumption for me to try and be sure. That more.
Yeah,
it would be somewhere between being assertive and aggressive, and I'm not sure if I was up to that at that point.
Yeah.
And maybe it was due. I mean, retrospective, as I say, maybe it was due to how I was treated and not feeling as confident in myself as I might have been. I think that's just, we can speculate about that, but okay. That's about it. So the outcome of all of that was around between 7th and 8th grade, I went to a what would now be called a magnet school. So and my folks decided that around eighth grade, which was when I was going to be 13, that it was time for me to, you know, get lessons for being a bar mitzvah, and it was maybe time to move. So we moved from that neighborhood to a place where there were a lot more Jewish people called Amberley Village in Cincinnati.
Oh,
and it wasn't exclusively Jewish by any means, but there were a lot more Jewish people. And so I started to attend Hebrew school in the afternoons, a couple days a week. It was kind of interesting at that point, because the high school I went to was 7 through 12, and this happened in the 8th grade. And I went ahead and came into the school and, you know, got introduced and whatever. In the 7th grade, nobody made much sense of it. And in the 8th grade, I start to show up to these Hebrew school lessons, and some of the young fellows and some of the young late girls said, "Whoa, we didn't know you were Jewish. You know, what are you doing here?" And because they, you know, had no idea when I just was entering into school that, you know, that was the case. Which sort of reaffirms that the permit name didn't make anybody immediately think that I was Jewish.
That's so weird, because in elementary school, they figured you were Jewish, but then they were older. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. So puzzling.
Yeah, it is puzzling. So, you know, this was a superb high school that really, you know, prepared me well. And classic school, you took Latin your first 3 years and had all sorts of advanced placement classes and stuff. And in the school, obviously, this was a school you had to test to get into and so forth. And people came from all over the city. So it was a wonderful melting pot from that standpoint. And there were clearly a lot of mixing of religions and mixing of cultures and backgrounds, a lot of black students, and obviously where I'd gone to grade school, there had been no black students before. There were some Asian students, as well as clearly some more Jewish students than I was used to seeing, as well as others. So that was a good experience until, and it wasn't bad, we're about to get to, but it was a little surprising. We had, at this high school when I went there, we had fraternities and sororities. And the fraternities and sororities were typically Jewish or not Jewish.
They were segregated even in high school.
So you didn't find Jewish people being rushed into non-Jewish fraternities or sororities or vice versa. And so that was, I'm pausing because I was going to say, on one hand, it's a little awkward because I had friends from the whole spectrum that I had made from grade 7, 8, and 9. And when you were in these fraternities or sororities, intermittently, obviously, you would have parties And so the dating was typically intra-faith, although there was some inter-faith dating. And so that was, again, a little awkward because it was a little bit foreign to me. No anti-Semitism per se and whatever. And I was very well regarded and respected, which was very nice. We had, you know, I played some basketball in an organized way for the junior high and into high school, and was well accepted as whoever I was as a person and as a player, not just because I was one religion or not another one. So that worked out fine. My last couple years of high school, I wasn't good enough to continue to play on the varsity in basketball. And so we had these fraternity leagues. And the team I was on was our team from our fraternity was not very good. I was the best player, not trying to toot my horn, just the way it was, and the rest of the people weren't so good. So what would happen is I would have friends on some of the other teams who were Christian when we were playing those, and this goes back to being more acceptance. I'll never forget this one fellow. We had a fellow who was the quarterback on the varsity football team, been quarterback in the pre-varsity and the varsity team. His name was Dick Stemmer, and Dick came up to me. He says, "Hey, can I be Stemmerstein and play with you this week?" You know, because we were playing his fraternity kind of thing. So, you know, at that point, there was a fair amount of acceptance, and that was positive. But, you know, then it comes time to go to college. And my folks started to relate to me stories actually about my dad. And this is germane to what we're talking about today as well. My dad was a very bright young fellow, went to Ohio State University and was like 16 because he had just done so well in school and passed and all that kind of stuff. Wasn't mature enough at that point really to stick with it completely, but eventually got a degree in chemistry and went to work for one of the major pharmaceutical companies in Cincinnati, Merrill Company, and also went to work for another company called Jergens. We make Jergens lotion. Maybe right. People know about that. And he, you know, did well and worked long hours and worked hard and never seemed to get promoted within the schema of either of these two major companies. And so this is, again, I was too young at the time. This is, you know, probably late 40s, early 50s when I was, you know, less than 10 at that point. But I heard about this later, obviously, and began to understand it. And he finally had a boss, a supervisor, sit down with him and said, "Maurice, you know, I don't know how to tell you this, but you're a superb chemist. You're a hard worker. You're just never going to get promoted here. And so maybe you ought to think about going back to school and becoming a professional where nobody can take things away from you. So you might want to think about pharmacy. You might want to think about medicine. But you ought to think about doing something different because you're going to be stymied the rest of your life in these corporations."
Did he tell your father directly it was because he was Jewish?
Yep.
Yeah.
So
it wasn't masked. It was straight out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was nothing subtle about it. But on the other hand, this fellow
was kind enough to tell.
Respected my father enough and his abilities and his capabilities to want him to have a different life than he was having. So, yeah, I was, as I say, probably about 8 or 9 years old, and my dad went back to pharmacy college.
Oh, wow.
And my mom worked to help, obviously, with the finances. And, he eventually became a pharmacist and eventually owned his own store and all those kinds of things. But again, when we think about, if you will, acculturated prejudice, Obviously, he encountered it. I encountered it. I mean, I'm obviously generations before him encountered it, and they are currently. So, you know, I think that most of us in life, I think, would just rather be viewed on our merits. And, you know, are you a hard worker? Are you bright? Are you capable? Can you learn? Can you work with other people? You know, whatever these positive attributes that might fit us well in society, and whether that be in an employment setting or another setting, social setting, you know, we'd prefer to be judged that way, if you will. And clearly, that doesn't happen all the time.
Certainly during that period of time.
No.
But even now, I'm sure.
No, no. You know, to move way into the more recent time of my life, a very interesting experience I had on the positive side. I know we're here to talk about anti-Semitism and its insidious nature and overt nature at times, for sure. But this was my effort, I guess, at overcoming it. But I, there was a healthcare system. I did, my career took me into a variety of healthcare systems around the country, where I was chief medical officer for multi-hospital systems and chief CEO of large group practices and things of that nature. And there was a time where we were a little unhappy with where we were in the in a particular setting. And I learned through a friend of mine that there was, I had been in Chicago for 7 years doing something else, and we'd traveled around since, and there was a job opening. It was for a chief medical officer of a 6-hospital Catholic healthcare system. And this friend of mine encouraged me to talk to the recruiter and be considered for it. Some of the practices that happen in Catholic healthcare systems are not consistent with my personal values, particularly those related to reproductive rights, but there's still a lot of good value in what many of these faith-based systems do in terms of their outreach to poor, their commitment to community, and their commitment to managing disease and health so that people don't get disease. So I decided I'd go listen and I'd go interview. And so one of the people who was on the interview panel was the, in a sense, the lead priest from the diocese that had authorization, you know, over this healthcare system. And so, you know, he asked me specifically about my thoughts about abortion and my thoughts about, you know, reproductive rights, and how would I handle things, you know, if I was the chief medical officer of this multi-hospital system, none of which hospitals did abortions, of course. Well, the irony, I mean, I reemphasized to all the people in the room that I was Jewish and that, you know, I would certainly fulfill the obligations of my job based on my professionalism. You know, there were certain things, obviously, that would make me uncomfortable. And how would we handle that? And we would need to handle that. It turns out what was interesting is, of all the people in the healthcare system, he became my closest ally, and we did some what you might call workarounds in sensitive situations where we either created referral networks or we handled some sensitive issues that, you know, that he supported, you know, sort of what I was doing, because he obviously liked the rest of what I was doing and appreciated sort of being a value-based individual, because that fit the value base, you know, that they were doing. So there are times when
it's not such a bad thing.
Yeah, we can work our way around that kind of stuff. But, you know, when you, if we want to get more to the current situation, I have to pause also and say that when you talked to me about coming here, you asked if I had any concerns that I might be somehow, if people knew who I was, you know, targeted in the future in a negative way. And I would go back to the 72 Olympics. If you remember, that's when those were the Munich Olympics. And that's when the sort of, if you will, the Nazi influence in Germany, you know, shot and killed a bunch of Israeli athletes during the Olympics. And, you know, I'm trying to think exactly how old I was, but, you know, I was in my, whatever I was, mid to late 20s or something of that nature by that point. And I remember feeling such simpatico, this goes back to what does it mean to be Jewish in a sense, with those people. I was not Israeli. I was born and reared in the United States. But I remember, I believe this is before I met my current wife, so I had a girlfriend at the time who was a seamstress. And I said to her, I said, can you sew me a black armband? I'd like to wear an armband out in public and around during this time to show my sympathy and my support for what had happened to this group. I didn't give any thought to the fact that
there might be
somebody who would not be happy about me doing that and coming to me in a hostile way. But I just felt that sense that I needed to evidence my compassion and my sympathy and my, as I say, my simpatico for those people, and in a sense, my brethren, if you will, you know, in Israel, who suffered this, you know, terrible situation.
Yeah. And what about a medical school, Rob? Did you experience any prejudice when you were going through your medical education?
You know, I can't say that if there was anything there, it was subtle and not overt, and I can't think of it. I certainly had, you know, again, a variety of professors, many of whom were obviously not Jewish, and a few were, and students similarly. I went to the University of Cincinnati, so I really can't say that I felt anything overt at that point. And obviously I made my, what you would call, typical progressions, you know, through medical school and internship and residency. And, you know, did my residency at Mayo's, and they had a rabbi, among other faith leaders who were serving as chaplains at the Mayo Clinic, and he was one actually I ended up marrying Marcia and me at that point, and there was a small temple there, and I remember being involved with they were doing some remodeling. I remember being involved with painting and whatever, we were able to engage some of the Christian community to help us with the remodeling and the decorating of this new temple. So that phase of my life, sort of the professional phase at that point, I didn't find overt Semitism, anti-Semitism at all.
And besides what happened with your father working at the in the pharmaceutical industry, when your parents were children, did they encounter anti-Semitism? That they ever said anything to you about?
You know, my mom grew up in sort of across the river from Cincinnati in Kentucky, but there was some semi-rural area in which she grew up. And her dad had a general store. And because he had the general store, and it would be a long trek for people to go more towards Cincinnati, he did okay business-wise and seemed to be accepted in the community. I think at school there were, as I encountered, and of course my mom was a female, but she had an older brother, Lou, and so there were some of that same kind of name-calling, taunting, baiting, you know, stuff going on that she encountered and her sister and my uncle encountered. But again, an interesting thing happened. And again, a tangent from what we're talking about. But there was a period of time, and I wouldn't know the years, but there had been some kind of sort of terrible flu outbreak or something of that nature in the community in which they lived, that somehow my grandfather, whom I never met, but for whom I'm named, seemingly didn't hit him. And a lot of these people were agricultural. And so he went around and milked cows for his neighbors, and was made a 33rd degree Mason by these people in this community. So it was quite a he was thanked forever, obviously, for doing that. So here's the kids who are undergoing taunting and name-calling in school, and yet some of these adults at some point in life obviously thought differently about what my grandfather had done for them, so as a human being, you know, helping them out. So
I ask you that because I'm slightly younger than you, but my parents grew up in Canada near Toronto, and my mother had her nose broken a couple times as a little kid for being Jewish, and my father was the subject of lots of anti-Semitism. So for the first 4.5 years of my life, I didn't know my real and last name because they took the Steen out of Saperstein and they called themselves Sapers so that they could pass in their community as non-Jews, because they were always living in fear of being persecuted. And for my mom, it became to violence as a little kid. So I remember the first time I heard my real last name, I said, that's not my last name. I didn't know what the hell's going on.
Yeah. So, well, I guess that's where Permit, and supposedly Permit really is Permit. It's not Permutsky or Permutstein or anything else. It really was that. But it's interesting that you mentioned that because, you know, I think that I have a friend here in town, and you were talking about sort of psychological impact on things. I have a friend here in town who's a retired anesthesiologist, and he and my wife worked together at the outpatient surgery center here in Santa Barbara at the Cottage Hospital when we lived here earlier. And we've been exchanging some articles about, including reading the original charter of Hamas. And he said, for the first time, he says, my parents left Austria in 1939. And he said, for the first time, and this is an email he sent to me the other day, he said, for the first time in my life, I have a feeling about what they were experiencing and how it has come home to roost. And it's very unsettling, I think was the word he used, and disturbing.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons why I wanted to do a couple of podcasts on anti-Semitism is because I have a fair number of Jewish clients, and I've been in practice for close to 35 or so years. Never before has the people that I've seen been worried. And even my wife, who's not Jewish, said to me just randomly, do I need to be worried?
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, this is so bizarre.
Well, it's really interesting. I have some friends back in the greater Chicago area who live in the Glen Ellen Wheaton area. Of course, Wheaton College is a very Christian college. But these friends have a, I would call it a very progressive congregation that they belong to, and they invited a rabbi just recently who lives in the community to come and speak about Hamas and what had gone on in Israel. And he's got a daughter living in Haifa right now who had some rockets certainly sent their way. And he was commenting that when he walked into their church, it felt very different than when he walked into his own synagogue that he was rabbi. And he paused when he said that, because I'm sure he wanted everybody in their mind to ask the question, well, how was it different?
Right.
And he said, well, and then he went on. He said, you know, when I walk into our synagogue, there's always a police car parked in the parking lot. And there's always an armed guard at the door. When I walked into your church, there was no police car in the parking lot. There was no armed guard at the door, and the door was wide open. And you could hear, this was a recording that they sent me of the of the sermon and of the whole service, and you could just hear a gasp,
I'm sure,
you know, from the audience in this church setting. So there's a lot that, you know, and we can go back to the, you know, the murder number of years ago, not that long ago, in Pittsburgh, the Tree of Life
synagogue,
and those kinds of things. And to understand that this is there, it's been boiling, I think it would be called roiling, which is sort of like boiling under the surface. And then I think this whole situation in Israel has really... set it off, along obviously with, we can blame our former president for enhancing these problems as well. But I think that this has set off the polarization even more, and it's become more dangerous. You know, people have asked me what are my thoughts about Israel, and I have been a steady supporter of Israel from the standpoint that I've purchased Israel bonds for years. I purchased bonds when my grandchildren are born. I support Technion University there, which does a tremendous amount of education and particularly research education. But I also have made it very clear that, you know, I've been for a two-state solution for years and years and years. I have been disagreeing with Netanyahu, who's the current prime minister, about that. And I think that you go back to 1948 when this whole first thing of the State of Israel came into being, and the so-called partitioning of land that was supposed to be Israel and supposed to not necessarily be a Palestinian state, but that was sort of the inference. And, you know, you can see where there's enmity on both sides. The Jews fighting to have their own homeland, and the Palestinians feeling like they've been dispossessed. And that's part of what's gone on, you know, even to this point. I mean, that's part of what some of this is about, not all of it. I mean, Hamas, obviously, is credo is just to murder all Jews and rid the world of them and have that land for themselves. I mean, that it's just right in their founding documents very clearly. But, you know, what Biden was trying to do, and I don't want to get political here, but particularly early on when he said, you know, there's a difference between Hamas and Palestinians. And, you know, we have a terrorist group who want to indeed terrorize people, which they've done. And we have a group of people who are not part of that, who just happen to be there sometimes for centuries, you know, who probably deserve their own land, and our fight's not with the Palestinians, it's with Hamas. And I thought the differentiation was important because, you know, Palestinians, in my mind, deserve to live side by side in peace with the Israelis and have their own land because it was their land too.
But what about the notion that they elected Hamas as being their government representative?
It's sort of like when the Russians vote, does Vladimir Putin continue to become president or not? You know, it's kind of similar. I mean, there's there's no bona fide opposition,
and
there's no
so they're stuck basically.
Yeah. You know, you read now a lot about, well, people are calling it the day after. And that means the day after the war ends, what's it going to look like?
Yeah.
And obviously, from a physical standpoint, it's a rubbled mess that will need rebuilding. So is there a equivalent Marshall Plan, so to speak, for that area, like we did after World War II? And who wants to do that? And then who's going to govern? And what does that look like? And again, I'm not a fan of what I hear Netanyahu saying about, well, we're going to occupy this for a while and whatever. Somehow, and this, I guess, goes back to maybe there's no good options, but to me, from what I've read and understood, you know, unfortunately, Abbas might not be the strongest leader, but we need somebody who's Palestinian, who has credibility with the majority of the Palestinian people who are not terrorists, to sit there and say, what do we want our life to be like? What do we want our, if you will, our country to be like? And we need, unfortunately, we need Benjamin Netanyahu to step aside and get away from all of his right-wing stuff too and put together some sort of coalition government that really just wants to, govern in a constructive way. And whether all my stuff is a fantasy here, I don't know. But Thomas Friedman wrote a really great article just yesterday in the New York Times talking about what he thought was going to be necessary as he saw it. And, of course, he's a pretty visionary kind of guy with all the stuff he's written. And he's talking about something of that nature. But some sort of coalition government that's constructive, if you will, in Israel, and some kind of coalition government that's constructive on the other side. Otherwise, this would end even uglier.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, part of what I've noticed, Rob, in my own feeling and thinking is that because I'm afraid, it brings out the worst in me, right? It's hard for me to stay connected to my conscience when I feel afraid, which I think is the biggest problem that fear generates in people, is that if it gets big enough, that we're capable of being horrid people, right? When we're scared enough or when we feel threatened enough. And so I think for the first time in my life, I don't know what to even think or feel about what's happening because it seems so just insane all the way around. And I can't imagine how it's going to end well for anybody.
Yeah,
I just don't know what to think that, you know, how because the prime minister is, you know, Trump's baby brother in Israel, and he just wants to kill everybody because that's his idea about how to solve problems. And, and we both know that that's not a great solution. But what is the solution?
It's obviously hard to know. And I was listening yesterday, as I mentioned earlier, I support Technion University, and they had one of their vice chancellors on who is an American from the standpoint he was born and reared here, trained at Johns Hopkins, but he's been over in Israel and on the faculty there for 30 some years and was an actual commando fighter leader at one point in his career. His son has been called up and drafted, and he was talking about what they're doing right now, which is really eye-opening because people have this sense of empathy for these Palestinians who have been displaced and feel, you know, some, everybody keeps talking about getting humanitarian aid there. Technion is supposed to be in session now, but they're not, and they can't be. A third of their students have been called up to serve, along with faculty and staff. What they've done with their dorms is they're now using their dorms for the displaced Israelis from the Gaza Strip and other places. Okay. They've opened their dorms up for these people to have a place. They've taken their cafeterias, obviously, and are now feeding these people. And they're already planning for, again, with the euphemistically continue to talk about it, it's the day after. They have, I don't remember how many students they have, but anyway, they have on their faculty, as many universities do, they have therapists and they have whatever. They're already planning for all the post-traumatic stress disorder that they anticipate seeing from their students and from the staff who would come back from the war. And he just said that on one hand, this is horrifying. I thought it was an interesting juxtaposition. On one hand, this is horrifying. On the other hand, it's heartwarming because everybody's pulling together, you know, kind of thing. And it goes back to what you're talking about. You know, when people are threatened, we're in the old flight or fight kind of, you know, the basic response when we got all this adrenaline going through us. And so they're trying to be constructive about how they're using their energy to sort of problem solve, you know, for their society and the way that they can, you know, as this university. So it's you know, I listened to this for an hour yesterday and I just sat there sort of like I am right in front of you, which is not a TV audience, but I was just sort of shaking my head because the impact of it all, when you think about all the ramifications, is just amazing.
So I have a question that's probably not answerable, but why do you think anti-Semitism is so prevalent considering how few Jews there are left in the world?
I think that people, unfortunately, I think back to what Trump has done and his acolytes and who he is appealing to. And he's been appealing to people that feel marginalized in a way, who feel that they haven't been heard, that they haven't been cared for, whatever. And it's then the next step in dealing with that is to say, okay, somebody else is holding you back. Somebody else has been successful and done what you could have done, should have done, might have done, and we're going to blame them. And I'm not saying that Jews as a group in America or around the world are the most successful people in the world, but they're on a proportional basis. There's certainly a lot more professional people, a lot more people who are well-educated, a lot more. I mean, that's just sort of a mantra because, like with my dad, he was told, you know, you need more education in order to overcome your barrier.
Right.
And so that was certainly pounded into my head, and I pounded it into my kids' heads.
Right.
You know, that this is what they need to do to give themselves a decent, at least socioeconomic footing in this country.
Right.
So I think there's some scapegoating. I think there's some that goes along with that. And so you end up with this group of people who, in a sense, unfortunately, haven't succeeded. And then you have a group of people who have, and it's a small percent of people, but it's of that percent, there's a large percent who have done well in general.
Right.
And I think that everybody needs to, again, people need a scapegoat when they need to take a look in a mirror and say, well, there's a reason. Maybe there's systemic something else going on elsewhere. But unfortunately, we're, you know, systemic prejudice, and we still have it against blacks in this country. They've been held back. We, ever since slavery, we got obviously systemic prejudice against Jews and others. And, you know, those are different reasons for those two things. They obviously came from different origins, the slavery
right.
versus what's happened to Jewish people. But, it's, again, all born out of ignorance, like I said at the very beginning.
I couldn't agree with you more. I actually grew up in, at least from 5 till the end of high school, in a very Jewish part of Los Angeles. So all the schools closed for Jewish holidays and all that sort of stuff. So I never really experienced any kind of anti-Semitism growing up. But when I was 18 years old, my parents decided to go back to Canada to show me where I was born. And we arrived at the airport and my uncle picked us up in his car and was driving us back to his house, and a car came up in front of us and stopped in front of us, and a bunch of guys got out with baseball bats and started screaming the most horrible anti-Semitic things at us, and they wanted to kill us. I'm sitting in the car looking out the window thinking, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
This is the craziest thing I've ever experienced in my life. And luckily, my uncle was, you know, smart enough to figure out a way to get away quickly. Otherwise, I have no idea what would happen. But man, was I grateful to my parents for coming to California.
Yeah.
I can tell you that.
Welcome to the real world, huh?
Yeah, it was so crazy. This was in 1973. I mean, it's not like this happened along, you know.
Right, right. Yeah.
So, again, so many people now that I see have been telling me, like I have a client who's in his 60s that grew up in Chicago.
Yeah.
He said every day he experienced the same thing that you did, but all the way through high school, that he was bullied and, picked on all the time and told the most horrible things. But unfortunately, his family was not capable of taking care of him. So he just had to endure. And I've known this guy for a long time. He's never even mentioned this before until all this is coming up. So I think it's bringing up a lot of pain for people that just kind of got over whatever they had to deal with as kids in the United States.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, you think back to the Charlottesville thing, though, not that long ago.
It's not that long ago. That's right.
And this whole rise of neo-Nazism and, again, being promoted by a certain cluster of sector of this country that it's distressing is understated. I sort of end up shaking my head because it's hard to fathom. I mean, land of the free, home of the brave, and all this kind of stuff. And yet, are we how free are we really? And particularly when we talk about freedom of expression and freedom to worship and all those other freedoms right. that supposedly were guaranteed. So, you know, there's this threat that it doesn't really, I mean, I think when you think about the political scheme of thing, the threat's not really coming from the Jews. It's going back to Washington and Jefferson, all this kind of stuff. Founding the country is this Christian country, and so here we are on a podcast, but I'm spouting off. But my fear is that, you know, we're sitting there saying, no, we got a lot of black and brown and whatever else coming here, and all of a sudden you're not going to be in the majority anymore. And so they're going to do everything. When you talk about fear, they're acting, they're going to do everything they can to keep power and control.
Right.
And that even if it means stirring up a civil war, even if it means stirring up, you know, hatred and whatever, right. so that, you know, you could have done better, but you've been threatened because all these other people or immigrants are coming in here and whatever else. So,
right.
you know, it's unfortunately very pervasive. And right now, of course, it's really focused on Israel and the Palestinian area, but you know, we're really talking about worldwide. I've got a cousin who's in Great Britain, did a lot of you know, research into the history of my dad's side of the family, and you know, even in Great Britain, you know, they're feeling much the same way that we are here. She and I have been exchanging some emails.
So, Rob, we're running out of time a bit. I'm curious about what you would like to tell the listeners of the Fear Me Out podcast that you would like for them to sort of think about and consider. I know that's a big question, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts or any ideas that you would like people to really do some pondering about in the face of all of this.
Met with silence. I mean, that's a imponderable almost. You know, I think it's very simplistic stuff, obviously, like accepting people for just being people and embracing differences and understanding that different religions, different cultures, different backgrounds enrich our experiences. My wife and I moved around the country. We live in different parts of this country. And each time we've learned something and we've met people that have enhanced our lives. So that diversity is enriching and it shouldn't be threatening. But for many people, I think it is.
Yeah. So we're coming up on a really important election between a dictator and I don't know who else is going to run against him.
Yeah.
And maybe he won't. But yeah. I've never been more frightened about a politician in my life either, because he is absolutely probably one of the most mentally ill politicians walking around. I don't care about his politics. I care way more about how dangerous he is
as
a person.
Well, it's interesting. My mom was more vocal. My mom was a staunch Republican when I was growing up. I grew up in Cincinnati, which is part of Hamilton County, which historically is a very Republican area, counterbalanced often by Cuyahoga County around Cleveland, which used to be more Democratic. And I was sort of inculcated in that for many years until I said, I really don't like a lot of these policies of trickle down from the, you know, and the rich should get richer and all this kind of stuff. We have all this inequity where now we have, you know, CEOs of major corporation making 1,000 times what the line worker does when 40 years ago they were making maybe 20 times as much. I mean, there's so much inequity in this world right now that's being and that's another reason we're so polarized. And so, you know, I campaigned. I've been involved in political campaigns for many years. Meaning not only donated, but I've gone door to door and I've written postcards and I've made calls through phone banks and whatever. But I think even my friends were just astounded at how involved I was 4 years ago and what I was doing and what I was asking them to do because of the threat. And you're right, the threat's even larger now. And there's a newsletter, a blogger by the name of Robert Hubble that I read. He's actually out of LA and very progressive thinker. And, you know, we talks about the threat and Biden wasn't wrong when he said, you know, you have a choice now in a sense between democracy and autocracy. And that's what people don't really understand. And right. So you and I probably wouldn't be able to have this conversation 3 years from now should somebody that we don't want to get elected gets elected. Right. I'm fearful right. about that. So I will, if I put effort in 4 years ago or whatever, how many years ago, it will be more this time because we can't sit back and let that happen.
No. Well, that to me sounds very hopeful, not letting that happen. So, Rob, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I think that you have lots of really important things to say. I don't think most people realize how much anti-Semitism that people just go through in their daily life because, you know, it's not something I can't imagine you've talked to many people about what happened to you when you were a kid, have you?
No. No, yeah, it's not something you talk about.
Yeah, you just kind of let it go. But I don't think, you know, it's time to come out of the Jewish closet, I guess. I don't know. I don't know how else to say it. So, again, I appreciate your willingness to come and share really important information.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yep.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.